And now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
A perfectly good brain wasted.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back. This is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura and Santa Barbara Counties. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is good things. Each of my guests is explaining good things in our lives, whether it's overcoming uncertainty, music, or achieving sales success. My next guest sang about good things, kicks, and Indian reservations back in the 1960s. He's the lead singer of Paul Revere and the Raiders. We'll talk to him about his music, his career, and his upcoming tour with Mark Lindsay. If you want to join in the conversation, or if you want to speak to Mark Lindsay, you can call us at 639-0008. Mark Lindsay was born in Eugene, Oregon. About the time that Louie Louie was recorded, his band decided to use Paul Revere and the Raiders as a gimmick to bill themselves as Paul Revere and the Raiders. They began to dress in Revolutionary War-style outfits. Mark Lindsay actually carried the theme a bit farther by growing his hair out and pulling it into a ponytail, which became his signature look. Lindsay and the group caught the attention of Dick Clark, who was developing Where the Action Is, an afternoon show for the teen market. Clark hired the group as regular performers, and the group soon became very, very successful. The Raiders were the first rock group signed by Columbia Records and were produced by Terry Melcher, interestingly enough, who is the son of actress Doris Day. Mark Lindsay had some great success with songs like Arizona, Silverbird, and Indian Reservation. Welcome to the show, Mark. How are you today?
I'm great, Bill. How's it going today?
It is.
Sounds like you did your homework.
Well, try to get a little bit smart about you. After all, this is Billy the Brain. I don't want to be caught with anything, you know, without knowing anything about you. And I'm glad to have you on the show because I really did love your music. I loved Arizona, one of those songs that once you get it in your head, you just can't get it out of your head. I mean, it's amazing that way. What is it about your music do you think that's so enduring, Mark?
Wow, man, that's a great question. I think that any music that's done, take a good song, produce it well, orchestrate it well, and put it on a record so it sounds, the sound sounds good, produce it, you know, like, you know, as I said. And if it's a timely record, if it happens to hit the ear at that time, I think it's like a painting, a good painting doesn't really wear out. I mean, it kind of endures through the years. Good music is good music. Good art is good art.
That's a great analogy. Good music is like a good painting. It endures through the centuries. There's no doubt about that. And in the 60s, you really achieved some pop stardom, some mega group stardom back then with Paul Revere and the Raiders, and then when you branched out on your own as well. What was it like really being a mega group, being a teen sensation back in the 60s?
It was a horrifying experience.
Really?
Well, not horrifying, but there was a real dichotomy between the real Mark Lindsay, which I saw myself as, and the Mark Lindsay that everyone else saw, the guy singing lead on their records and the guy jumping around on television and touring, because I grew up in the Northwest, and I was always a very shy kid. Even though I loved music and was kind of a class clown and a goof, I was very, you know, like I said, very retiring, and after after the action was over, I would kind of slink off to my corner and curl up.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. So, I was very self-conscious, I suppose, partially because I've always had been very, very nearsighted. So I wore thick glasses from the time I was 8 years old, and this kind of so much teasing from other kids, you know, this is the era before contact lenses.
Right.
And, hey, four eyes, what's going on? Hey, Coke bottles, what's happening?
Wow. I mean, it happens to everybody, I guess. It just goes to show you.
Yeah, I mean, I was no different. I was just another kid growing up in a small town, and we happened to get very, very lucky, get out of Idaho, become popular on a nationwide basis. And as I said, there was a total black and white resolution between trying to justify or quantify the guy I thought I was inside and the guy everyone else thought I was outside.
Yeah, sure. I mean, but besides that split personality, which definitely was a downside to the experience, what would you say the upside to the whole experience was?
Well, I'm slightly bipolar, so it goes further than my thoughts. There's the upside was wonderful. It was I remember being back in Idaho and going to a, we're going back to the to like 1960, and we had just made a decision to cut our first demo, and we cut the demo and sent it off to a record company, and I remember Revere and I went to a fortune teller in Idaho, in Boise, and at the end of the session, she asked, we went in separately, but she asked me to make a wish, and I'll tell you whether it'll come true or not. And I made the wish, and she said, yes, your dream will come true way, 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 I don't know exactly how she couched it, but she said, in far in excess of your wildest dreams, your dream will come true. And my wish at that time was just to have a record on the Billboard chart.
Wow. How about that?
And she said, your dream will come true in spades, and it did, and it was very heady stuff. It was on one hand, you know, I'd be on the top of the world thinking, man, this is incredible. And it was. I mean, it was. I'd listen to the records as a kid and think of, and I'd attended some concerts. I saw Buddy Knox coming through Idaho and Bobby V. And I thought, man, if I could ever be up there, that would be just the best thing. And it was. It was incredible. On one hand, it was the best thing that ever happened. And on the other hand, when I went home or the music stopped and I had to go back to being just plain old Mark Lindsay, which at the time I thought was, it was just hard to pull the two together. Now I have, after time has gone by, I realize that, yeah, there's still two guys. There's one guy that gets on stage and just does what he does and loves it. And there's a guy who gets off stage and just lives a normal life. I mean, right now, I'm sitting here in Florida. I'm looking out over a beautiful river. And in fact, there's an alligator technically upstream. I'm sitting outside. I've got some shorts on. I've got a baseball cap on. And just chilling. And, you know, I actually think that most of the people around here don't know, have any idea who I am, and it doesn't matter. I'm just another guy, and loving life, thanking God for the music, and there you go.
There you go. My guest is Mark Lindsay. We're talking about life, the music, and everything. And, Mark, it was interesting because you were performing during one of the more tumultuous times in U.S. history, both politically and musically. And your music has been termed pop rock, which I think is unfair because your music actually tackled some of the tougher issues of the day. Songs like Kicks and Indian Reservations were mild protest songs at the very least, and probably strong protest songs for the time. In what ways, Mark, did your music reflect the times that you were playing in?
Well, you just mentioned two of them. Kicks, although I can't take credit for Kicks, it was written by Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, a wonderful songwriting team who've written hundreds of songs, songs like We Gotta Get Out of This Place and You've Lost That Love and Feeling, and on and on and on. And they wrote a song called Kicks, and the lyrics go, Kicks just keep getting harder to find, and all your kicks ain't bringing you peace of mind. And I thought it just meant, hey, it's harder to have a good time now than it used to be back in the day.
And
it was actually written for Jerry Goffin, Barry and Cynthia, were one songwriting team, and Goffin and King were another. Carol King is out there most recently with James Taylor. She's still good, as good or better than ever. But at the time, they wrote the song as a warning to Jerry Goffin. Barry and Cynthia wrote, let me start this again. At the time, Barry and Cynthia wrote the song for Jerry, Jerry Goffin, the half of Goffin, half of Goffin and King, as a warning, because apparently this is the 60s, and it was an experimental period for America and for most of the kids, and Jerry was dabbling in substances that were way powerful and probably beyond what he should be doing, and it was written as a little caveat for him, to him, like, you know, hey, you know, you thought you found the answer on that magic carpet ride last night, but when you wake up in the morning, the world still gets you uptight, so drugs aren't the answer.
Yeah.
I didn't realize it was an anti-drug song.
Oh, until, really?
Yeah, and, well, I'm this green kid from Idaho. What do I know? So about 2 weeks after the song popped onto the charts in the top 10. I get a call from Newsweek, being interviewed for an article. They say, "How does it feel, Mr. Lindsay, to have been the singer, lead singer on the first anti-drug song?" And I went, "I did." I was so naive, I didn't realize what the song was actually saying. But it was very timely. There was, at the time, I was living with Terry Melcher. You mentioned that
yes.
in the promo. Terry and I were sharing a house, writing music. And I remember this friend of his who was a doctor. He volunteered at UCLA. He was in pre-med. And every weekend, he'd get like 200, 300 kids totally freaked out of their mind on smack, acid, something. They were just, you know, they'd gone too far.
Mm.
And some of them didn't come back. And at the time, I remember, you know, I asked him, "Well, what's, you know, I'm thinking about maybe taking a going off into the wild blue yonder." He said, no. He said, "If you are very psychologically stable, maybe, but if you have any hint of psychosis in your personality, don't do it." And knowing myself as I did, well, that answers that question. I'm slightly out of it already. I think I'll just stay as far out of it as I am normally.
Well, as it turns out, that's a good thing for you. My guest is Mark Lindsay. Mark, I'm going to change things up a little bit and ask you what I know is a very difficult question, because it's like asking a father to choose his favorite child. But which of the songs in your mind stands out as being the quintessential Mark Lindsay song?
Wow. Okay, I'll have to give you a couple. I mean, as you said, it's like choosing a child. We're talking about protest songs, and we have to mention Too Much Talk.
Yeah.
And Too Much Talk stands out because it was the first record that I produced. I was working with Terry, and I was kind of co-producing, although I really wasn't getting credit for it. I was just watching Terry and helping him. But we needed a single. CBS was screaming for a single, and Terry was in Spain with Candy Bergen. Hey, I would have been too.
Yeah.
She'd asked me. But we needed a single, and they said, "Hey, Terry, you've got to come back and produce a single." I said, no, I'm on vacation. I'll do it when I get back. So they're frantic, because in those days, you needed a record on the chart, and when one started coming down, they wanted you to release another one to replace that one. They didn't want any time to go by without you on the top of the charts if they could help it. So finally, Grace, and they said, "Look, can you produce a record?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. Aren't you helping Terry? Don't you know how to do it?" I said, "Well, watching and thinking is not the same as doing." So finally, they twisted my arm. I said, "Okay." And I had just written this song basically about, you know, in those days, the song, "There's Something Happening Here."
Yes, For What It's Worth, the Buffalo Springfield.
For What It's Worth. Yeah, and there were thousands of kids in the street. I remember driving home from the studio, and just, you know, I had a Ferrari at the time, and people would come up and jump on the car or start to, and like, "Hey, who's this guy?" And they see that he was a kid, you know, in his 20s with a ponytail. So I was okay. I could go through. Literally, they took over Sunset Boulevard, and we were going to change the world. It was like a youth movement. People didn't like the war, you know, like people were dying. It's hey, there are some similarities with then and today, I have to say, but we thought we could change everything. I'm talking about the kids. And one of the things was every politician would campaign and say, "Yes, and when I get elected, I'm going to change this, that," and you can just kind of fill in the blanks.
Mm-hmm.
But nothing ever changed. Once they got in office, all the campaign promises were forgotten. Just wait a minute. Doesn't that sound really familiar? So I wrote this song called "Too Much Talk and Not Enough Action." And even though it wasn't really played in New York or Los Angeles that much, it did make it to number 11 on Cashbox. So that was one of my favorites.
Good.
In Reservation. I produced and sang it, and it was the biggest selling single in the history of CBS Records. I also had the message. I have a little Native American in me, some Cherokee.
Do you? Oh, okay.
Yeah, many Americans do. And when Jack Gold approached me to sing the song, he said, "Well, I've got this great song, you know, Indian Reservation." And at the time, it was just totally the time for it. At the time, there was a movement in America that there was a big awareness of maybe how the Native Americans had been treated fairly shabbily in the couple centuries before.
Yes.
And Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee was number one on the New York Times bestseller list.
And Marlon Brando made his big stand at the Oscars, too.
Yeah, it was just time that was in the air. So I sang the song with you know, incredible conviction. There was nothing phony about it. I was just pouring my heart out, and I really pulled out all the stops on that record. And when I got through, I loved the record, but I was so close to it, I couldn't predict where it would go. I usually could call a record that I produced. I'd say, okay, this is going to be top 20, this will be top 30, this will be 7, you know. I could get it within 5 points either way.
Wow.
Indian Reservation, I had no idea. In my heart, I thought this is either going to be the biggest record I've ever done or the biggest stiff that no one will ever hear. And I just was so close to it, I couldn't call it. And, of course, as I said, it turned out to be about 7 million seller, the biggest 45 in the history of CBS Records to that time.
And, to that point, yeah, that's amazing. My guest is Mark Lindsay. Mark, we're running out of time, unfortunately, but I did want to talk to you about going out on tour. You're going out on tour this summer in what's called the Happy Together Tour. Who are some of the other bands? And you're coming here to the Chumash Casino in the Santa Ynez area on August the 11th. So tell us about the tour.
The tour is going to be 2.5 hours of the hits from the 60s. We have The Association, The Grassroots, The Turtles, The Buckinghams, and yours truly, leads the man that sang all the Paul Revere and the Raiders hits.
Yeah, marvelous. And
plus, I'm going to bring my saxophone along, because in the early days of the Raiders, if people came to see the group, they saw an R&B group before we got on TV. So I'm going to bring the sax, blow a number or two, and then get right into the hits. And It's just a little chunk of time when things were a lot better, a lot smoother, at least in a few ways.
Yeah, that is great. My guest has been Mark Lindsay. Mark, it has truly been a delight. Thank you so much for spending some time with us. We'll talk to you down the road.
Thank you so much, Bill.
Thank you.